Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday service for July 28th. My name is Tom O'Bannon, and I'm pleased to be your service leader this morning. At this time, I would like to extend a special welcome to our guests, guest speaker Thomas Attic, and to our guest musician, Catherine Whitney. Good morning, Tom and Catherine. We're very happy to have you here with us today. As a gentle reminder, would everyone please ensure that they have turned off their cell phones and any other electronic devices that may interrupt today's service. We extend an especially warm welcome to our visitors this morning. If there are any newcomers or people back after a long absence who would like to introduce themselves, we invite you to do so now. Please stand and wait for Robin to bring you a microphone so that everyone may hear your name. If you did not introduce yourself today, please know that the right time to do so is when it feels right to you. In every case, you are all most welcome here. After the service, we invite visitors to stop by the visitors' table at the back of the sanctuary. Church members will be available there to answer any questions you may have about our congregation. At the visitors' table, you may also sign up to receive our newsletter and other information about this church. Please read the announcements in your order of service, which highlights some upcoming church events. Visitors are also encouraged to read the welcome visitor section. We have two special announcements this morning. Stu and Emily Whitney's nephew died yesterday morning after a two-year journey with cancer. There is a card to sign at the back of the sanctuary. Also, the monthly newsletters for August are ready for pickup. Please pick yours up in the lobby after the service. That'll save us some postage. Let us now proceed with this morning's service. We bid you welcome, who come with weary spirits seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome, who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome, who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome, who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are in your journey, we bid you welcome. Penny Boyce will now light our chalice. In times of grief, we light a flame of sharing, the flame of ongoing life. In times when we search for understanding and serenity in the face of loss, we light this sign of our quest for truth, meaning, comfort, and community. Members of the Solstice Choir, please come forward now to sing this morning's introit. May it be. today's responsive reading, entitled We Need One Another, is number 468 in your hymnal. I will read the parts in regular font, and Tom will read the italicized parts. Please pick a part, one or the other, and join in. Got yours? Okay. We need one another when we mourn and would be comforted.
We need one another when we are in trouble and afraid.
We need one another when we are in despair, in temptation, and need to be recalled to our best selves again.
We need one another when we would accomplish some great purpose and cannot do it alone.
We need one another in the hour of success, when we look for someone to share our triumphs.
We need one another in the hour of defeat, when with encouragement we might endure and stand again.
We need one another when we come to die, and would have gentle hands prepare us for the journey.
All our lives we are in need, and others are in need of us.
Now please rise, as you are willing and able, and join in the singing of hymn number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Raiden will play through it once just to remind us how it goes. This month is going to support the Rainbow Refugee Society, a grassroots organization that supports people seeking refugee protection because of persecution based on sexual orientation, gender identity, or HIV status. After the offering has been received from your roll, those who wish to do so are invited to come to the front of the sanctuary to tie a cloudy, a little cloth strip, in hope or remembrance. To facilitate this process, more than one person may tie a cloudy at a time. Whether or not you come forward, everyone is invited to use this quiet time for reflection and meditation. The ushers will now receive the gifts of the congregation. What is given in love is received in gratitude. Thank you, Braden. For today's meditation, we turn to author Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me and I waken in the night in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and where the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. And for a time I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. That was beautiful and very touching. It's indeed a pleasure to introduce today's guest speaker, Thomas Attic, Professor Emeritus in Applied Philosophy at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He is past president of the Association for Deaf Education and Counseling. He presently teaches online courses on ethical and spiritual issues faced at the end of life. Now living in Victoria, Tom serves as chair of the Spiritual Care and Wellness Ministry at First Metropolitan United Church. His newest book, Catching Your Breath in Grief and Grace Will Lead You Home, highlights 40 years of reflection on the spiritual dimensions of grief and loss. This morning, Tom has a message of hope about brokenness, sorrow, and resilience in loss. Tom.
Thank you for that, Tom. Appreciate being introduced so nicely. It is a privilege to be here. I'm so grateful to have been asked. I know that part of the privilege is that as I speak to you about this topic, many of you are out there contending with losses in your life right now. Not only losses through death, but other major losses. It's a season for sunshine, but it's also a season for sorrow. They're all seasons for sorrow. My mother always wanted me to be a minister. Growing up in a Missouri Synod Lutheran church and thinking of myself as a recovering Missouri Synod Lutheran, I found it hard to go along with her idea, but I think I found a different ministry in teaching. And a modest prayer as people begin these things: may something I say or a story I tell speak to you in your brokenness, sorrow, or appeal to your resilience. Amen. Tom put one of my favorite quotations in your program, so you have it to take with you. And if you remember nothing else of what I have to say, you've at least got that quote. A wise person once said, "Although our world is full of suffering, it is full also of the overcoming of it." And I'm going to speak to both. In the 1970s, when I began to teach about, think about, write about, eventually, grief and loss, the emphasis was on grief reaction, on the brokenness and sorrow that come over us when someone we love dies. The emphasis in that quotation was on the suffering, not on the overcoming. There was talk about Kubler-Ross's famous five stages, supposedly stages of dying, but quickly understood as stages of grieving. You know the drill. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. There was writing about medical perspectives on grief and loss, taking our behaviors and our reactions as symptoms of a kind of underlying disease that we come down with when someone has died. In both of these ways of understanding things, grieving is thought of as passive, as something to be endured. Well, that's half the story as I see it. My teaching and writing since then has emphasized grieving response, which is what we do with what has happened to us. Loss has happened to us, and brokenness and sorrow coming over us have happened to us. What do we do in response? How do we actively engage with what has happened to us? My experiences and my listening to countless other people have told me that it's best to understand grieving response as a process of relearning the world. More specifically, learning how to live again in a world that's been radically changed by the losses that have come into our lives. Today I have stories to tell you about what I've learned about brokenness, sorrow, and resilience. Loss after one's a loved one's death is what I'll be emphasizing in these stories. That's the topic I know best, but I also know that this message speaks to and applies to other losses you may be dealing with. So again, let me remind you as I speak about brokenness and sorrow. Although our world is full of suffering, that's what I'll talk about first, it is full also of the overcoming of it, and that's what I promise to talk about a bit later. About brokenness, I met a man named Doug Daher, D-A-H-E-R. I taught a brief course with him one summer. He wrote a book called And the Passenger Was Death, and he was writing about his experience of his 20-something son falling off a roof to his death. And this is how he wrote of his brokenness. He said, "I am a figure of glass on a glass mantle, attached to a glass wall, in a glass house, located within a glass community, a part of a glass country, which is located on glass earth. The delivery is made, and the small crack begins to spread, and all the glass is breaking. All is in shambles. One of the parts left is large enough to rise in order to walk, eat, talk, cry, and sleep. But it is all shattered glass." I've never heard a better passage than that to describe the brokenness that people can feel when a loved one has died. We've all known brokenness in some form. This powerful imagery, I hope, resonates with you. The great web of life that holds us all doesn't break. But our subjective experiences of chaos in our own individual lives suggests that it does. It can be very disconcerting as the world goes on, as if nothing has happened around us. Yet there is much support and comfort in that wider web that's really not broken. Let me tell you the beginnings of three stories. Brokenness came into Helen and Roger's lives. I used to have these people come into my workshops. Their three-year-old daughter fell off of a swing in their backyard one day. There was no fracture, but she was clearly in serious trouble. They took her into the hospital, and as they examined her, determined no concussion, no broken skull, she had an underlying illness that was life-threatening. And this fall triggered a rapid cascade that led to her dying 3 days later. Here we have an unexpected illness and the suddenness of it all taking, as you might imagine, their breath away. They faced returning to life with their five-year-old son, who was the brother of this young girl, Mary, who had died, returning to a home, a yard, a neighborhood where Mary walked and played and enjoyed life, a neighborhood filled with reminders of Mary. Brokenness came into Catherine's life when, as a relatively young married woman, she was in her early 30s, she learned of her husband's cancer. In the second summer of his illness, it became clear that he was not going to live until the holidays. He would be leaving her with two children, Josh and Sarah, under 5 years of age. The worst of it for Mark, she asked him, was that Josh and Sarah, he feared, would not remember him because they were so young, and he would die. Catherine faced the daunting, unanticipated future without Mark. Brokenness came into Julie's life. Julie was three. Her dad left her with her grandmother to take her mother to the hospital, anticipating the birth of a baby sister for Julie. The baby was stillborn. Dad came home without the baby. "Where is she?" asked Julie. "With Jesus," her parents told her. She was supposed to understand that, but she didn't. And she began acting out as children do. Her parents, in grief, couldn't calm her. Think about the brokenness in these people's lives. any ego illusions that they may have had, and Julie may not have had time to develop them yet, although she might have, were shattered. An illusion of control, out the window. Illusion that you can fix anything, out the window. An illusion that you're invulnerable, gone. An illusion that you are an exception by virtue of a strong faith or something like that. No, we're all in the human condition. Everyone has to, sometime or another, deal with sorrow. Their daily life patterns were shattered, could not possibly be, again, what they had been, with a major character now missing in their lives. Couldn't be just as it was. Their daily lives couldn't be just as they were. They have to deal with things and places, experiences and activities, interactions with others, and what's going on within their own skin, everything shattered or shadowed by loss. Their life stories are disrupted. They cannot have the wholeness that they anticipated they would have with these characters as part of those stories. They're painfully separated from their loved ones. Ties to family, community, friends, some of whom don't know what to say to them, don't know what to do in response to them, who kind of walk away when they see them coming and so on. Those ties are also shaken. Some of them even feel betrayed by God, and understandably so. The sorrow that comes over them is a mirror on their brokenness. The sorrow that comes over us all when we encounter major loss stops us just as physical pain stops us. I'm a funny guy. I'm a philosopher by training. I always wondered, what about this term emotion? Have you ever wondered what the E is in front of motion? What exactly is going on with motion when you're feeling emotion? Well, it surprised me when I looked it up, but then as I thought about it more, I wasn't all that surprised. Emotion means without motion. Both physical and emotional pain persist when there is serious brokenness. Both of them invite us to give this brokenness the attention that it deserves. If a physical pain persists because we're neglecting our knee or our hip or our back and so on, it will get worse until we do pay attention to it. Emotions work the same way. They stop us in our tracks. They're crying for attention. They have much to tell us about deep needs within us, about our souls and spirits and so on. And if we try to walk away from them, paper over them, drink ourselves into oblivion and so on, they'll just come back at us with renewed vigor until we pay attention. When we attend to physical and emotional pain, we can be compassionate with ourselves. We can grow in understanding of our deep needs. We can begin to see how we can draw on resilience within us and in our surroundings to contend with what's happened with us. I've got a small book in progress that'll happen sometime soon on grief and sorrow-friendly practices. There are lots of practices we can engage in that enables us to look at and learn from our emotions rather than running away from them. So much about brokenness and sorrow. Resilience. Again, that quotation. Although our world is full of suffering, it is full also of the overcoming of it. I've sketched the suffering, now about the overcoming. Helen. Helen went to her daughter's funeral. Remember, 3-year-old Mary had died? She was greeted by the priest. She was Catholic. The priest said, "Congratulations." She said, "Pardon me? Congratulations." And he meant, "You now have an angel in heaven." She said, "If I could have mustered the strength, I would have punched him out on the spot. But I didn't." Clearly for him, sorrow and tears were out of order because faith is supposed to obviate that. She quoted to my classes when she came the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. "If it's okay for Jesus, it's probably okay for me," she said. She was confident that God is compassionate, however you want to think of a God. Her neighbor, in contrast to the priest, said, Look, our daughters used to play with one another. I know that Mary has died. When you're ready and when you want to, please come over, have coffee. I've got some photos I'd like to show you. She went. People who are grieving want to talk about the people who have died, and to see those photographs and so on was wonderful for her. They viewed the photos, they remembered their children as they played together, and they cried together. She said, "Don't be afraid of making us cry. We're crying anyway. We're crying anyway." She noticed that there were several of her friends who couldn't be with her and couldn't really listen to her. She and another couple and her husband formed a support group for bereaved parents. At first, they attended those meetings out of deep needs for themselves, to tell their stories, to find support and comfort, to learn what other people were doing in relearning how to live in a world without a dead child. The sharing helped, and their compassion grew. And as so often happens, they stayed in that support group later, not out of personal need, but to offer compassion to others. That's resilience. Catherine, she realized that Mark wasn't going to be there for the holidays. She was horrified at the thought of all kinds of cards coming in from people wishing them both well, and having to send out individual notes and so on about how Mark has died, and it was going to be really complicated. She had an insight. She thought, what I will do is I will contact the whole holiday list, people that we send cards out to and so on, and I'll tell everybody that Mark is dying, that he's not likely to be here for the holidays, and I will ask them to send a message to Mark about what they remember about him, what they love about him, what they value and honor in him, and so on. I'll gather those things together. She got over 100 responses. She gathered them into 3 scrapbooks. She and Mark spent 3 nights together poring over those books, laughing and crying together. She learned a lot about Mark. Mark learned a few things about himself and how he was appreciated by others as well. Mark was deeply touched and said to her, "This book, aside from the children and your love, my dear, is the finest gift I have ever received." Catherine, after Mark did die, embraced his legacies in reshaping and redirecting her life. He left her insurance money. He had always said, "You got to go back and become a nurse administrator. You're a fine nurse, but I know you want to be an administrator." She took the money and went back to school. She talked to Mark nightly before she went to sleep, asking his advice about how to take care of the kids, how to run the finances, and so on and so on. She used the books to help Josh and Sarah know their dad. Every one of his birthdays, every holiday, any time the kids wanted the books to come out. And they're little kids, so early on, the visits in the books were very superficial. They'd look at the pictures, make a couple of comments, and then go off and play. But as they grew, they came to know their father very well, as they were able to understand the messages that had come in from all those friends. Eventually, she saw how they were becoming like Mark. Mark was in them. She was grateful for becoming confident, nurturing, gentle, affectionate, and patient in life with Mark. She cherished their home, places that they walked, favorite recipes, their song, their church, their children, Mark's parents, and so on. She persevered through tears. It was Mark's desire that she thrive again one day in a world he wished he could share with her. She took to heart his wish for her to reach out for another and welcome new love, if and when the time seemed right. And 5 years after Mark died, she married again. Now the story of Julie. I love this. I'm going long. Bear with me. This is a neat kid, 3 years old. The parents knew she needed help. They happened to know a friend of mine named Roy, who was funeral director in town, They were having the funeral done with his help. They asked him, "Do you have any experience in talking with children?" He did. He said he would be willing to come and speak with Julie. It would be best to speak with her at their home. They invited him to come. They gathered around the table in the kitchen, started talking. They invited Julie to come in and sit with them. She was very reluctant. Finally, he hit on the idea of maybe she would like to draw with him. He asked her. She kept peeking in and out, but not coming in to sit down. "Do you know how to draw?" he says. She says, "Yes. Would you like to draw with me? Have you got some paper, crayons, and so on?" "Well, yeah." So she goes and gets them. He asks the parents to sit down at the other end of the table, not go away. That right there, she's feeling safe in the presence of her parents. "Let's draw some animals, all right? Here's a stack of paper for you. Here's a stack of paper for me. Draw your favorite animal." She draws a dog. He draws a cat. She draws a squirrel. He draws a cow. She draws a horse. He draws whatever. Then he says, "Let's put those pictures over here, all right? Have you ever seen a dead animal?" "Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw a dead bird by the sidewalk just the other day. You think you could draw that?" She draws a dead bird. He says, "Let's put that over here. I saw a dead squirrel once, squished in the road." He draws this thing. "Let's put that over here." They draw more and more dead animals. And she says, "Draw dead animals, live animals, whatever you want." So the live ones are over here. The dead ones are over here. He says, "You think you could draw Jesus?" "Oh, yeah. All right. Well, why don't you draw Jesus?" She draws Jesus. "Where does Jesus go?" "I don't know." "Well, why don't we just put him in the middle?" "Okay." At this point, he knows that she understands the difference between dead and alive, and knows it pretty well. And she's puzzled about Jesus because he's supposedly around, but he's dead, but he's alive, but doesn't make a lot of sense to her. He said, "I understand you had a baby sister." "Yeah." "You think you could draw her?" "Yeah." "Where does she belong?" "Over here." She knows her sister's dead. He says, "I've got your sister down at my funeral home." "You do? I want to see her." She doesn't know quite what a funeral home is. "I want to see her." He says, "Look, it's late at night. I'm perfectly fine with you seeing your baby sister. We should ask your parents if that's okay with them." "Oh, yeah, that would be fine." "Well, this isn't really the time because it's really your bedtime. I want you to think about whether you really want to see your sister at night or not. And you can call me as early as you want tomorrow morning. Do you know how to use a telephone?" And they had little dial phones then. You remember them? "Show me that you know how to dial." He wrote down his phone number. She knows how to dial. "If you call me and you want to come down, I can then talk to your parents and we'll have you come down. I'm going to ask you if you dialed the phone or someone dialed it for you. I'm going to ask you if your parents told you to dial or if you decided to do it yourself. At about 6:30 in the morning, you got a call from Julie. All right? Can I come see my sister now? Are your parents awake?" "No, I just got up and called you." "Well, why don't we wait a little while and we'll wake up your parents and so on." Anyway, they brought her down. She comes in the place and says, "Where's my sister?" "Well, she's behind that door over there in a box at the end of the room," and so on. "Oh, fine." She goes and plays with toys that he's got there in his funeral home for kids and looks at little books and so on. Comes back and says, "I'm ready now. Take me in there." And he says, "I'll take you in there, but I'd rather that you take my hand and bring me into the room. And if at any time you decide you want to come back out, you just bring me back out. You don't have to go down to the end of the room once you're in the room." It's all the time he's putting her in charge of her own experience. You understand this? She goes in the room, takes him up, and there's the little baby in the baby casket. And she says, "She's not dead. She's asleep." He says, "Well, no, actually." And he puts his hand on the baby and shakes the baby and says, "If she were alive, she'd wake up." She says, "You're not doing it right." Well, you try, he says. You wake her up. You're right. She's dead. When do we bury her? She rode in the hearse in the front seat. She stood at the base of the grave until her sister was buried. She insisted on staying until all the dirt was in the grave, and so on. She went home. Did she act out anymore? No. Did she understand reality of the death of her sister? Yes, because she saw it, touched it, felt it herself. Did she feel as if her experience was radically out of her control? No, because she'd been put in control of her own experience. She did quite well. A very resilient young person. Even children are resilient. These stories only begin to illustrate resilience that enables overcoming of sorrow. Active re-engagement is possible because of what bends but does not break within us. The breath of life itself that courses through us, our egos capable of solving problems, our souls and spirits, and our love for those who have died. None of these is broken. The breath of life and the depths of soul, spirit, and love within us are easily construed by me anyway as God within us or the divine within us that enables us to rise above and overcome our sorrow, enable us to envision possible paths to meaningful life through our own efforts. That's our responsibility. And then there's the great web and the love of God that are not broken either, there to support us. We can be receptive to and grateful for opportunities for meaningful living that come from others and from the universe or the grace that holds and surrounds us all. One last story, quickly. A man wrestling with his faith. C.S. Lewis, author of A Grief Observed, you may know of him, married for the first time late in life to a woman named Joy. Within a very few years, Joy died. She had been ill when they married. She went into remission for a couple of years, and then she died. Early in his experience of grief, he was in agony, missing her. The memories he found were receding behind intense sorrow. The more intense his sorrow, the harder it was for him to remember Joy. He said it was like losing her for a second time. He wrestled with his doubts about the grace of God. He was angry at God, and he found that God's response, as he perceived it, was to slam a door in his face. When he needed him the most, he didn't seem to be there at all. Later, he awoke one morning. The grip of sorrow had lessened, and he remembered Joy far more vividly than he had for many months. He said it was almost as if she were present with him in the room. Near the end of the book, he writes that he finds himself praising Joy, enjoying her again. We do that when we praise someone or something, don't we? We enjoy them again. He was grateful for her love and their sharing life together. He praised God in turn, feeling close to the divine again. He was grateful for having been given the opportunity to meet Joy in the first place, for being enabled by this grace of the universe to know and to love one another. We'll always miss the physical presence of those we love, but we can always be grateful for living together, memories, legacies that keep giving. When resilience helps us come to gratitude, it has brought us from the depths of gripping sorrow to a far better place where we can love in separation, which we do most of the time anyway. One last thing. The wise person who once said, although our world is full of suffering, it's full also of the overcoming of it, was Helen Keller. And you know the rest of her story. Talk about resilience. Amen.
Thank you for your thoughts and insights, Tom. Let's sing a song. Please rise as you are willing and able and join in the singing of a favorite hymn, Find a Stillness, number 352 in your hymnal. voice will now extinguish our chalice. And from the poet Mary Oliver, our closing words. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours. I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, over the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Over and over announcing your place in the family of things. May you go now in peace. Peace be with you. Song. It is our custom to stand and join hands, as you're willing and able, and to sing Carry the Flame. The words are in your order of service.